Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We bring you Donald Barthelme this time. Barthelme is considered one of the most important writers of the 20th century and central in the postmodern school of writing that includes John Barth, John Hawkes, William Gass, Robert Coover, and Thomas Pynchon. In his New York Times obituary, the paper said he was a writer whose minimalist style placed him among the leading innovative writers of modern fiction. Born in Houston in 1931, Barthelme moved to New York in 1963. He first rose to national prominence when his first novel, Snow White, was printed in its entirety in The New Yorker, taking up virtually the entire issue. In all, he published 8 books of stories and 4 novels in his storied career. This talk is from 1989, recorded less than a year before Barthelme's untimely death at just 58 years old, and is one of the earliest recordings in our archive. Join me for Donald Barthelme here on Literary Arts, the Archive Project.
I've just come from Texas. Everybody in Texas, I must tell you, is watching television. They're watching a 4-part miniseries having to do with the heroic early history of the Pacific Northwest. It's called Lonesome Salmon. Seems to be extremely popular. I'd like to begin tonight by reading you a little piece about a child. It's called Chablis. My wife wants a dog. She already has a baby. The baby's almost 2. My wife says that the baby wants the dog. My wife has been wanting a dog for a long time. I have had to be the one to tell her that she couldn't have it. But now the baby wants a dog, my wife says. This may be true. The baby is very close to my wife. They go around together all the time, clutching each other tightly. I asked the baby, who is a girl, whose girl are you? Are you daddy's girl? The baby says, mama. And she doesn't just say it once, she says it repeatedly. Mama, mama, mama. I don't see why I should buy a $100 dog for that damn baby. The kind of dog the baby wants, my wife says, is a Cairn Terrier. This kind of dog, my wife says, is a Presbyterian like herself and the baby. Last year, the baby was a Baptist. That is, she went to the Mother's Day Out program at the First Baptist twice a week. This year, she is a Presbyterian because the Presbyterians have more swings and slides and things. I think that's pretty shameless, and I have said so. My wife is a lifelong legitimate Presbyterian and says that makes it okay. Way back when she was a child, she used to go to the First Presbyterian in Evanston, Illinois. I didn't go to church because I was a black sheep. There were 5 children in my family, and the males rotated the position of black sheep among us, the oldest one being the black sheep for a while he was in his DWI period or whatever, and then getting grayer as he maybe got a job or was in the service, and then finally becoming a white sheep when he got married and had a grandchild. My sister was never a black sheep because she was a girl. Our baby is a pretty fine baby. I told my wife for many years that she couldn't have a baby because it was too expensive. But they wear you down. They are just wonderful at wearing you down, even if it takes years, as it did in this case. Now I hang around the baby and hug her every chance I get. Her name is Joanna. She wears Oshkosh overalls and says, no, bottle, out, and mama. She looks most lovable when she's wet, when she's just had a bath and her long blonde hair is all wet and she's wrapped in a beige towel. Sometimes when she's watching television, she forgets that you're there. You can just look at her. When she's watching television, she looks dumb. I like her better when she's wet. This dog thing is getting to be a big issue. I said to my wife, well, you've got the baby. Do we have to have the damn dog, too? The dog will probably bite somebody or get lost. I can see myself walking all over our subdivision asking people, have you seen this brown dog? What's its name? They'll say to me. And I'll stare at them coldly and say, Michael. That's what she wants to call it, Michael. That's a silly name for a dog. And I'll have to go looking for this possibly rabid animal and say to people, have you seen this brown dog, Michael? It's enough to make you think about divorce. What's that baby going to do with that dog that it can't do with me? Romp? I can romp. I took her to the playground at the school. It was Sunday and there was nobody there. And we romped. I ran and she tottered after me at a good pace. I held her as she slid down the slide. She groped her way through a length of big pipe they have there, set in concrete. She picked up a feather and looked at it for a long time. I worried that it might be a diseased feather, but she didn't put it in her mouth. Then we ran some more over the parched bare softball field and through the arcade that connects the temporary wooden classrooms, which are losing their yellow paint, to the main building. Joanna will go to this school someday if I stay in the same job. I looked at some dogs at Pets Aplenty, which has birds, rodents, reptiles, and dogs, all in top condition. They showed me the Cairn Terriers. Do they have their prayer books, I asked. This woman clerk didn't know what I was talking about. The Cairn Terriers ran about $2.95 per with their papers. I started to ask if they had any illegitimate children at lower prices, but I could see that it would be useless, and the woman already didn't like me, I could tell. What is wrong with me? Why am I not a more natural person like my wife wants me to be? I sit up in the early morning at my desk on the second floor of our house. The desk faces the street. At 5:30 in the morning, the runners are already out, running toward rude red health. I'm sipping a glass of Gallo Chablis with an ice cube in it, smoking and worrying. I worry that the baby may jam a kitchen knife into an electrical outlet while she's wet. I put those little plastic plugs into all the electrical outlets, but she's learned how to pop them out. I've checked the Crayolas. They've made the Crayolas safe to eat. I called the head office in Pennsylvania. She'd need a whole box of Crayolas, and nothing will happen to her. If I don't get the new tires for the car, I can buy the dog. I remember the time 30 years ago when I put Herman's mother's Buick into a cornfield on the Beaumont Highway. There was another car in my lane, and I didn't hit it, and it didn't hit me. I remember veering to the right and down into the ditch and up through the fence and coming to rest in a cornfield and then getting out to wake Herman up and the two of us going to see what the happy drunks in the other car had come to in the ditch on the other side of the road. That was when I was a black sheep, years and years ago. That was skillfully done, I think. I get up, congratulate myself in memory, and go in to look at the baby. Thank you. I'd like to read you now a piece about angels. Called On Angels. The death of God left the angels in a strange position. They were overtaken suddenly by a fundamental question. One can attempt to imagine the moment. How did they look at the instant the question invaded them, flooding the angelic consciousness, taking hold with terrifying force? The question was, what are angels? New to questioning, unaccustomed to terror, unskilled in aloneness, the angels, we assume, fell into despair. The question of what angels are has a considerable history. Swedenborg, for example, talked to a great many angels and faithfully recorded what they told him. Swedenborg says, angels look like human beings. Quote, that angels are human forms or men has been seen by me 1,000 times. And again, quote, from all of my experience, which is now of many years, I am able to state that angels are wholly men in form, having faces, eyes, ears, bodies, arms, hands, and feet. But a man cannot see angels with his bodily eyes, only with the eyes of the spirit. Swedenborg has a great deal more to say about angels, all of the highest interest. That no angel is ever permitted to stand behind another and look at the back of his head, for this would disturb the influx of good and truth from the Lord. That angels have the east, where the Lord is seen as a sun, always before their eyes, and that angels are clothed according to their intelligence. Quote, some of the most intelligent have garments that blaze as if with flame. Others have garments that glisten as if with light. The less intelligent have garments that are glistening white or white without the effulgence, and the still less intelligent have garments of various colors. But the angels of the inmost heaven are not clothed. All of this, presumably, no longer obtains. Gustav Davidson, in his useful Dictionary of Angels, has brought together much of what is known about them. Their names are called the angel Alubitel, the angel Friagni, the angel Gap, the angel Hotaphos, genius of finery, the angel Murmur, a fallen angel, the angel Mutro, the angel Or, the angel Resh, the angel Sandalphon, who is taller than a 500 years journey on foot. Davidson distinguishes categories: angels of quaking, who surround the heavenly throne, masters of howling and lords of shouting, whose work is praise, messengers, mediators, watchers, warners. Davidson's dictionary is a very large book. His bibliography lists more than 1,100 items. The former angelic consciousness has been most beautifully described by Joseph Lyons in a paper titled The Psychology of Angels, published in 1957. Each angel, Lyons says, knows all that there is to know about himself and every other angel. Quote, no angel could ever ask a question, because questioning proceeds out of a situation of not knowing and of being in some way aware of not knowing. An angel cannot be curious. He has nothing to be curious about. He cannot wonder. Knowing all that there is to know, the world of possible knowledge must appear to him as an ordered set of facts, which is completely behind him, completely fixed and certain and within his grasp. But this, too, no longer obtains. It is a curiosity of writing about angels that very often one turns out to be writing about men. The themes are twinned. Thus, one finally learns that Lyons, for example, is really writing not about angels, but about schizophrenics, thinking about men by invoking angels. And this holds true of much other writing on the subject, a point we may assume that was not lost on the angels when they began considering their new relation to the cosmos. When the analogs, is an angel more like a quetzal, or more like a man, or more like music, were being handed about. We may further assume that some attempt was made at self-definition by function. An angel is what he does. Thus, it was necessary to investigate possible new roles. After the lamentation had gone on for hundreds and hundreds of whatever the angels use for time, An angel proposed that lamentation be the function of angels eternally, as adoration was formerly. The mode of lamentation would be silence, in contrast to the unceasing chanting of glorias that had been their former employment. But it is not in the nature of angels to be silent. A counterproposal was that the angels affirm chaos. There were to be five great proofs of the existence of chaos, of which the first was the absence of God. The other four could surely be located. The work of definition and explication could, if done nicely enough, occupy the angels forever, as the contrary work has occupied human theologians. But there is not much enthusiasm for chaos among the angels. The most serious, because most radical proposal considered by the angels was refusal, that they would remove themselves from being, not be. The tremendous dignity that would accrue to the angels by this act was felt to be a manifestation of spiritual pride. Refusal was refused. There were other suggestions, some more subtle and complicated, others less so, none overwhelmingly attractive. I saw a famous angel on television. His garments glistened as if with light. He talked about the situation of angels now. Angels, he said, are like men in some ways. The problem of adoration is felt to be central. He said that for a time the angels had tried adoring each other, as we do, but had found it finally not enough. He said they are continuing to search for a new principle. Everyone knows about Dr. Johnson and Boswell. The great German writer, dramatist, poet, color theorist, universal sage Goethe had his own Boswell. It's a man named Eckermann, J.R. Eckermann, who published an incredible book called Conversations with Goethe. He was Goethe's Boswell. I'm going to read you now a story called Conversation, a very short piece actually, called Conversations with Goethe, which Eckermann did not write. Conversations with Goethe. November 13th, 1823. I was walking home from the theater with Goethe this evening when we saw a small boy in a plum-colored waistcoat. Youth, Goethe said, is the silky apple butter on the good brown bread of possibility. December 9th, 1823. Goethe had sent me an invitation to dinner. As I entered his sitting room, I found him warming his hands before a cheerful fire. We discussed the meal to come at some length, for the planning of it had been an occasion of earnest thought to him, and he was in quite good spirits about the anticipated results, which included sweetbreads prepared in the French manner with celery root and paprika. Food, said Goethe, is the topmost taper on the golden candelabrum of existence. January 11th, 1824. Dinner alone with Goethe, Goethe said, I will now confide to you some of my ideas about music, something I have been considering for many years. You will have noted that although certain members of the animal kingdom make a kind of music, one speaks of the song of birds, does one not? No animal known to us takes part in what may be termed an organized musical performance. Man alone does that. I have wondered about crickets, whether their evening cacophony might be considered in this light as a species of performance, albeit one of little significance to our ears. I have asked Humboldt about it, and Humboldt replied that he thought not, that it is merely a sort of tick on the part of crickets. The great point here, the point that I may choose to enlarge upon in some future work, is not that the members of the animal kingdom do not unite wholeheartedly in this musical way, but that man does, to the eternal comfort and glory of his soul. Music, Goethe said, is the frozen tapioca in the ice chest of history. March 22nd, 1824. Goethe had been desirous of making the acquaintance of a young Englishman, a Lieutenant Whitby, then in Weimar on business. I conducted this gentleman to Goethe's house, where Goethe greeted us most cordially and offered us wine and biscuits. English, he said, was a wholly splendid language, which had given him the deepest pleasure over many years. He had mastered it early, he told us, in order to be able to savor the felicities and tragic depths of Shakespeare, with whom no author in the world before or since could rightfully be compared. We were in a most pleasant mood and continued to talk about the accomplishments of the young Englishman's countrymen until quite late. The English, Goethe said in parting, are the shining brown varnish on the sad chiffonier of civilization. Lieutenant Whitby blushed most noticeably. April 7th, 1824. When I entered Goethe's house at noon, a wrapped parcel was standing in the foyer. And what do you imagine this may be? Asked Goethe with a smile. I could not for the life of me fathom what the parcel might contain, for it was most oddly shaped. Goethe explained that it was a sculpture, a gift from his friend Van den Broet, the Dutch artist. He unwrapped the package with the utmost care, and I was seized with admiration when the noble figure within was revealed, a representation in bronze of a young woman clad as Diana, her bow bent and an arrow on the string. We marveled together at the perfection of form and fineness of detail, most of all at the indefinable aura of spirituality which radiated from the work. Truly astonishing, Goethe exclaimed, and I hasten to agree. Art, Goethe said, is the 4% interest on the municipal bond of life. He was very pleased with this remark and repeated it several times. June 18th, 1824. Goethe had been having great difficulties with the particular actress at the theater. A person who conceived that her own notion of how her role was to be played was superior to Goethe's. It is not enough, he said, sighing, that I have memed every gesture for the poor creature, that nothing has been left unexplored in this character I myself have created, willed into being. She persists in what she terms her interpretation, which is ruining the play. He went on to discuss the sorrows of managing a theater, even the finest, and the exhausting detail that must be attended to every jot and tittle if the performances are to be fit for a discriminating public. Actors, he said, are the Scotch weevils in the salt pork of honest effort. I loved him more than ever, and we parted with an affectionate handshake. September 1st, 1824. Today, Goethe inveighed against certain critics who had, he said, completely misunderstood Lessing. He spoke movingly about how such obtuseness had partially embittered Lessing's last years, and speculated that it was because Lessing was both critic and dramatist that the attacks had been of more than usual ferocity. Critics, Goethe said, are the cracked mirror in the grand ballroom of the creative spirit. No, I said, they were rather the extra baggage on the great cabriolet of conceptual progress. Eckermann, said Goethe, shut up! Thank you. I'd like to read you now something from a piece I'm working on. This is to be a short novel, which I haven't quite finished, and it is unfinished to the point where it doesn't have a title as yet. I haven't been so far able to come up with a decent title for it. The basic situation for the novel, it could be called King Arthur and the Round Table Boys in the Second World War, if you want to. That's the ground situation. No title has yet presented itself. So I'll read you two or three little excerpts from it just to give you the flavor of it. And possibly to reassure myself. It begins with there are two guys who are kind of a chorus who comment on certain aspects of the action, and they're very excitable fellows. And the novel begins with these fellows, the chorus members, observing Launcelot riding across the scene. See there, it's Launcelot riding. How swiftly he goes, as if unchafed by a fiend. The splendid muscles of his horse move rhythmically under the drenched skin of same. By Jesu, he is in a vast hurry. But now he pulls up the horse and sits for a moment, lost in thought. Now he wags his great head in daffish fashion. He reins the horse about and puts the golden spurs to her. But that is the direction from which he lately came with such excessive speed. No, it's slightly different. It's at an angle of about 15 degrees to the first. This breakbone pace will soon unhorse him. Not Launcelot. Launcelot is the greatest horseman in the realm. Look you, Launcelot and his horse have plunged into a deep mire. He's thrown. The horse is down. Now the horse struggles to his feet. But Launcelot's still on the ground. Perhaps he's broken something. No, he's up. He inspects the horse. He leaps into the saddle. He reins about once again. Now he rides off furiously in still another way. He burns the ground with his careening. It is as if he hears beams bugling from every quarter of the compass. His responsibilities are grave and many. Look there. There is another knight in Launcelot's path. The twain have feuted their spears. They hurtle fast together. The knight who is not Sir Launcelot is shocked out of the saddle. He rises in the air, turning end over end. Launcelot wallops on, doesn't even stop to smite the fellow's head off, but pounds ever more fiercely toward a distant goal. I'm losing sight of him. His figure dwindles and grows small. I can see him still getting smaller and smaller in the remote distance, riding. And among the characters in this piece are Ezra Pound, who is, as he historically did, broadcasting obnoxious anti-Semitic stuff from Rome, and Lord Haw-Haw, who was an expatriate Englishman named William Joyce, broadcasting anti-British propaganda from Berlin. So in the next scene, I won't read you all of it, but Arthur, King Arthur, with his right-hand man, Sir Kay, is listening to the radio. The Bolshevik anti-morale, said Ezra, comes out of the Talmud, which is the dirtiest teaching that any race ever codified. The Talmud is the one and only begetter of the Bolshevik system. In a moment he'll be talking about kikified usurers, said Arthur. One expects poets to be mad. But he reminds me, said Sir Kay, of some old country squire in Surrey somewhere running on after dinner to his poor, bedraggled wife. I suppose one could knit to this, Arthur said. It would induce concentration. You would do better to inoculate your children with typhus and syphilis, said Ezra, than to let in the Sassoons, Rothschilds, and Warburgs. See if you can get something else, said the king, or better shut it off. I can remember when we didn't have any damned radio clattering at us day and night. I heard some Schoenberg just the other day, said Sir Kay, the suite for piano. I have never understood your taste in music, dear Sir Kay. No, the Queen's. Guinevere likes music with much dolor in it, the most dolorous, as if life didn't contain enough. I like music with a slightly more affirmative cast, if I may put it that way. Queens are usually rather conservative, musically speaking, said Sir Kay. I've known a good many, and most of them go for the old war horses. I've never known a queen who could stand Bruckner, play them a bit of Mahler, and they fall into a pout. Queens get so few chances to express themselves, said Arthur. They save them up to spend on something important. By the way, said Sir Kay, there's one missing. Fiona, Queen of Gore. There was a bulletin on the teletype. Where is Gore? I don't don't recall, in the north somewhere. In any case, she's been out of pocket for some weeks. Has she a husband? How old is she? She's 22. The king's quite a bit older. She's probably out misbehaving, said Arthur. Try to keep it from the papers. I don't know why I should have to worry about such things when there's a war on. They say she's quite lovely, said Sir Kay. That's interesting. One of the most beautiful women in the realm, they say. That's interesting. Said to have a remarkable figure. I have put such things behind me, more or less, said Arthur. You know that, of course, sire. Just bringing you up to date. Is there anything else? Gawain has swapped off a damsel's head by accident. Again. God in heaven, said Arthur. Who was it? A daughter of King Zog. Her name was Linet, I believe. Then we'll have Albania up in arms, said Arthur. All the hatred the Albanians have for the Italians wasted. Gawain always gets them on the rebound, the damsels. He makes a stroke. The stroke bounces off his opponent's helmet or whatever and detaches the head of the lady standing nearby. It's happened far too often. Doesn't make us too good in the press. Ha-ha has been commenting on it. No one pays any attention to ha-ha. I quite disagree with you, said Arthur. People hang upon his words. They find him delicious. The entire English-speaking world believes that Lancelot is sleeping with Guinevere. Oh, I doubt it, said Sir Kay. She's 36. Do people still sleep with women when they're that age? Each to his own taste, said the king. I have not lain with Guinevere these dozen years. Not that I'm not fond of her, you understand, but 24 is my absolute upper limit, always was and always will be. Quite sound, said Sir Kay. Perhaps it's a sort of pietistic relationship. Lancelot and the queen, perhaps they read improving works together, go to early mass together, make novenas, things of that nature. Guinevere has no more religion than a cat, said Arthur. There are also letters from King Victor Emmanuel, said Sir Kay. I've read them, said Arthur. Most unpleasant. The Italians want Yugoslavia, Greece, and God knows what else. In the old days, said Sir Kay, we'd have made the messenger eat the letters, including the seals. I have never abused messengers, said Arthur. I think that's rather low. And we have a wire from the Queen, something about a locomotive welded to the tracks by the railway union. Yes, 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 said Arthur. Who is the chief of the railway men now? I assume they want more money, as do the men in the shipyards. There's a Pole who's been speaking for both groups. I forget his name. Give them a bit more money, said Arthur, and raise the tax on a pint commensurately. No, said Sir Kay. Increase the tax first, then give them the rise. That's the ticket. It's less obvious. They think I'm made of money, said Arthur. The supply of money is finite. They don't realize that. They think I have great strong boxes filled with money in all the cupboards and attics of all my castles. And so you do, said Sir Kay. Yes, but that's not the point, said Arthur. That money is not mine in any real sense. It's the state's money, England's money. We needed to keep the country going. Who knows what may happen in this war? We may lose. We may have to ransom ourselves or the whole bloody kingdom. It's only prudent to keep a bit laid by for contingencies. The man in the street never worries about contingencies. And then at a later point, Arthur is talking about Lancelot. Throughout the novel, Lancelot writes footnotes to everything that's going on, mostly disagreeing with what is happening at the top of the page. He's quarreling with it at the bottom of the page. But in this particular instance, Arthur is talking about Lancelot's heroism at the Siege of Andorra. Arthur says, think of the Siege of Andorra. We were magnificent. Lancelot inside the castle, leading the defense. He was incomparable, as always. You should have seen him on the battlements, hurling hives of bees down at the besiegers. He loves hurling hives of bees down at the besiegers. We lost, of course. And then Lancelot has a scholarly footnote. In hurling hives of bees, the trick is to get the hive over the parapet before the bees are fully awake. The hives have been treated with a soporific that keeps the bees comatose until they are brought onto the battlements. Your squire is, of course, standing by your side to hand you a fresh hive as you aim the first, and so on. Okay, that's a taste of that. Thank you. And now I'd like to read you a rather sad New York story. I live in New York most of the time. And the story is called Visitors. Visitors, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Bishop's daughter is ill, stomach pains. She's sleeping on the couch. Bishop, too, is ill, chills and sweating a flu. He can't sleep. In bed, he listens to the occasional groans from 2 rooms away. Katie is 15 and spends the summer with him every year. Outside on the street, someone kicks on a motorcycle and revs it unforgivingly. His bedroom is badly placed. He's given her Pepto-Bismol. If she wakes again, he'll try Tylenol. He wraps himself in the sheet, pulls his T-shirt away from his damp chest. There's a radio playing somewhere in the building, big band music. He feels rather than hears it. The steady, friendly air conditioner hustling in the next room. Earlier, he'd taken her to a doctor who found nothing. "You've got a bellyache," the doctor said. "Stick with fluids. Call me if it doesn't go away." Katie is beautiful, tall with dark hair. In the afternoon, they'd gone groaning to a horror movie about wolves taking over the city. At vivid moments, she jumped against him, pressing her breasts into his back. He moved away. When they walk together on the street, she takes his arm, holding on tightly, because, he figures, she spends so much of her time away. Very often, people give them peculiar looks. He's been picking up old ladies who've been falling down in front of him these last few days. One sitting in the middle of an intersection, waving her arms while dangerous yellow cabs curved around her. The old ladies invariably display a superb fighting spirit. "Thank you, young man," they say. Bishop is 49, writing a history of 19th century American painting, about which he knows a thing or two. Not enough. A groan, heartfelt but muted, from the other room. She's awake. He gets up and goes in to look at her. The red and white cotton robe she's wearing is tucked up under her knees. "I just threw up again," she says. "Did it help?" "A little." He once asked her what something, a box, a chair, was made of, and she told him it was made out of tree. "Do you want to try a glass of milk?" "I don't want any milk," she says, turning to lie on her front. "Sit with me." He sits on the edge of the couch and rubs her back. "Think of something terrific," he says. "Let's get your mind off your stomach. Think about fishing. Think about the time you threw the hotel keys out of the window." Once in Paris, she'd done just that from a 6th-floor window, and Bishop had had visions of some Frenchman walking down the street with a set of heavy iron hotel keys buried in his brain. He'd found the keys in a potted plant outside the hotel door. "Daddy," she says, not looking at him. "Yes. Why do you live like this, by yourself?" "Who am I going to live with?" "You could find somebody." "You're handsome, for your age." "Oh, very good. That's very neat. Thank you." "You don't try." "This is and is not true." "How much do you weigh?" 185. "You could lose weight." "Look, kid, give me a break." He blots his forehead with an arm. "Do you want some cambric tea?" "You've given up." "Not so," he says. "Katie, go to sleep now. Think of a great big pile of Gucci handbags." She sighs and turns her head away. Bishop goes into the kitchen and turns on the light. He wonders what a drink would do to him or for him, put him to sleep. He decides against it. He turns on the tiny kitchen TV and spends a few minutes watching some kind of Japanese monster movie. The poorly designed monster is picking up handfuls of people and, rather thoughtfully, eating them. Bishop thinks about Tokyo. He was once in bed with a Japanese girl during a mild earthquake. And he's never forgotten the feeling of the floor falling out from underneath them or the woman's terror. He suddenly remembers her name, Michiko. "You know Butterfly on me?" she had asked when they met. He was astonished to learn that Butterfly meant, in the patois of the time, abandon. She cooked their meals over a charcoal brazier, and they slept in a niche in the wall, closed off from the rest of her room by sliding paper doors. Bishop worked on the copy desk at Stars and Stripes. One day a wire photo came in showing the heads of the four then women's services posing for a group portrait. Bishop slugged the caption, "Leading Ladies." The elderly master sergeant, who was serving as city editor, brought the photo back to Bishop's desk. "We can't do this," he said. "Ain't it a shame?" He switches channels and gets Dolly Parton singing, by coincidence, "House of the Rising Sun." At some point during each summer, Katie will say, "Why did you and my mother split up?" "It was your fault," he answers. "Yours. You made too much noise as a kid. I couldn't work." His ex-wife had once told Katie this as an explanation for the divorce, and he'll repeat it until its untruth is marble, a monument. His ex-wife is otherwise very sensible and thrifty, too. "Why do I live this way? Best I can do." Walking down West Broadway on a Saturday afternoon, barking art, caged in the high white galleries, "Don't go inside or it'll get you," "Leap into your lap and cover your face with kisses." Some goes to the other extreme, snarls, and shows its brilliant teeth. "Oh, art, I won't hurt you if you don't hurt me." Citizens parading, plump-faced and bone-faced, lightly clad, a young black boy toting a Board of Education trombone case, a fellow with oddly cut hair, the color of marigolds, and a roll of roofing felt over one shoulder. Bishop in the crowd, $30 in his pocket, in case he has to buy a pal a drink. Into a gallery, because it must be done, the artist hung 20 Everlast punching bags in rows of four. You're invited to have a bash. People are giving the bags every kind of trouble. Bishop, unable to resist, bangs one with his left and hurts his hand. Bloody artists. Out in the street again, he's bumped into by a man, then another man, then a woman. And here's Harry in lemon pants with his British friend Malcolm. "Harry, Malcolm, professor," Harry says. Ironically, he is a professor, Bishop is not. Harry's got not much hair and has lost weight since he split with Tom. Malcolm is the single most cheerful individual Bishop has ever met. Harry's university has just hired a new president who's 32. Harry can't get over it. 32? I mean, I don't think the board's got both oars in the water. Standing behind Malcolm is a beautiful young woman. "This is Christy," Malcolm says. "We've just given her lunch. We've just eaten all the dim sum in the world." Bishop is immediately seized by a desire to cook for Christy, either his eight-bean soup or his crash cassoulet. She's telling him something about her windows. "I don't care, but why under my windows?" She's wearing a purple shirt and is deeply tanned with black hair. Looks like an Indian. In fact, the one who sells Mazzola on TV. Harry is still talking about the new president. I mean, he did his dissertation on bathing trends. Well, maybe he knows where the big bucks are. There's some leftover duck in the refrigerator Bishop can use for the cassoulet. "Well," he says to Christy, "are you hungry?" "Yes," she says, "I am." "We just ate," Harry says. "You can't be hungry. You can't possibly be hungry." "Hungry, hungry, hungry," she says, taking Bishop's arm, which is, can you believe it, sticking out. Putting slices of duck in bean water while Christy watches The Adventures of Robin Hood with Earl Flynn and Basil Rathbone on the kitchen TV. At the same time, Hank Williams Jr. is singing on the FM. "I like a place where I can take my shoes off," she said, as Earl Flynn throws a whole dead deer on the banquet table. Bishop Shopping Parsley is taking quick glances at her to see what she looks like with a glass of wine in her hand. Some people look good with white wine, some don't. He makes a mental note to buy some Mazola, a case maybe. Do you live with anybody? Christie asks. My daughter is here sometimes, summers and Christmas. A little tarragon into the bean water. How about you? There's this guy, she says. But there had to be. Bishop chops steadfastly with his three sheep brand Chinese chopper made in gray Fushan. He's an artist, she says, as who is not. What kind of an artist? Bishop asks. A painter. He's in Seattle. He needs rain. He throws handfuls of sliced onions into the water, then a can of tomato paste. How long does this take? Christie asks. I'm not rushing you. I'm just curious. Another hour. Then I'll have a little vodka. Straight. Ice, if you don't mind. Bishop loves women who drink. Maybe she smokes. Actually, I can't stand artists, she says. Like who in particular? Like that woman who puts chewing gum on her stomach? She doesn't do that anymore, and the chewing gum was not poorly placed. And that other one who cuts off parts of himself, whittles on himself, that fries my ass. It's supposed to, Bishop says. Yeah, she says, shaking ice in her glass. I'm reacting like a bozo. She gets up and walks over to the counter and takes a lark from his pack. Very happily, Bishop begins to talk. He tells her that the night before, he had smelled smoke, had gotten up and checked the apartment, knowing that a pier was on fire over by the river and suspecting it was that. He had turned on the TV to get the all-news channel, and while dialing had encountered the opening credits of a Richard Widmark cop film called Brock's Last Capes, which he had then sat down and watched his faithful Scotch at his side until 5 o'clock in the morning. Richard Widmark was one of his favorite actors in the whole world, he told her, because of the way in which Richard Widmark was able to convey what was the word resilience. You could knock Richard Widmark down, he said. You could even knock Richard Widmark down repeatedly, but you had better bear in mind while knocking Richard Widmark down that Richard Widmark was pretty damn sure going to bounce back up and batter your conch. Redford is the one I like, she says. Bishop can understand this, he nods seriously. The thing I like about Redford is, she says, and for 10 minutes she tells him about Robert Redford. He tastes the cassoulet with a long spoon. More salt. It appears that she's also mighty fond of Clint Eastwood. Bishop has the sense that the conversation has strayed like a bad cow from the proper path. Old Clint Eastwood, he says, shaking his head admiringly, we're ready. He dishes up the cassoulet and fetches hot bread from the oven. Tastes like real cassoulet, she says. That's the oxtail soup mix, he says. Why is he serving her cassoulet in summer? It's hot. He's opened a bottle of Robert Mondavi Table Red. Very good, she says. I mean, I'm surprised, really. Maybe he could have had more tomato, he says. No, really. She tears off a fistful of French bread. Men are quite odd. I saw this guy at the farmer's market on Union Square this morning. He was standing in front of a table full of greens and radishes and corn and this and that. And behind a bunch of other people, there was this farmer girl he was staring at. She was wearing cutoffs and a tank top, and every time she leaned over to grab a cabbage or whatnot, he was getting a shot of her breasts, which were, to be fair, quite pretty. I mean, how much fun can that be? Moderate amount of fun, some fun, not much fun. What can I say? And that plug I live with, she says. What about him? He gave me a book once. What was it? Book about how to fix home appliances. The dishwasher was broken. Then he bought me a screwdriver. This really nice screwdriver. Well, I fixed the damn dishwasher. Took me 2 days. Would you like to go to bed now? No, Christie says. Not yet. Not yet. Very happily, Bishop pours more wine. Now he's sweating. little chills at intervals, he gets a sheet from the bedroom and sits in the kitchen with the sheet draped around him, guru style. He can hear Katie turning restlessly on the couch. He admires the way she organizes her life, that is, the way she gets done what she wants done. A little wangling, a little nagging, a little let's go take a look. And Bishop has sprung for a new pair of boots, handsome, ankle-height, black Diablo numbers that she'll wear with black ski pants. Well, he doesn't give her many presents. Could he bear a scotch? He thinks not. He remembers a dream in which he dreamed his nose was as dark and red as a Bing cherry, as would be appropriate. Daddy, still wearing the yellow sheet, he gets up and goes into the other room. I can't sleep, she says. I'm sorry. Talk to me, she says. Bishop sits again on the edge of the couch. How large she is. He gives her his art history lecture. Then you get Monet and Manet. That's a little tricky. Monet was the one who did all the water lilies and shit. His colors were blues and greens. Manet was the one who did bare ass on the grass and shit. His colors were browns and greens. Then you get Bonnard. He did all the interiors and shit. Amazing light. And then you get Van Gogh. He was the one with the ear and shit. And Cézanne, he's the one with the apples and shit. You get Kandinsky, a bad mother, all them pickup sticks pictures. You get my man Mondrian. He's the one with the rectangles and shit. His colors were red, yellow, and blue. You get Mahaly Nagy. He did all the plastic thingamies and shit. You get Marcel Duchamp. He's the devil in human form. She's asleep. Bishop goes back to the kitchen and makes himself a drink. It's 5:30, faint light in the big windows. Christie's in Seattle and plans to stay. Looking out of the windows in the early morning, he can sometimes see the two old ladies who live in the apartment whose garden backs up to his building, having breakfast by candlelight. He can never figure out whether they are terminally romantic or whether, rather, they're trying to save electricity. Thank you. I think I have time for one more. I'd like to return to the subject of children. It is not quite the obsession that the evening might suggest. This piece is called The Baby. The first thing the baby did wrong was to tear pages out of her books. So we made a rule that each time she tore a page out of a book, she had to stay alone in her room for 4 hours behind the closed door. She was tearing out about a page a day in the beginning, and the rule worked fairly well, although the crying and screaming from behind the door were unnerving. We reasoned that that was the price you had to pay, or part of the price you had to pay. But then, as her grip improved, she got to tearing out 2 pages at a time, which meant 8 hours alone in a room behind the closed door, which just doubled the annoyance for everybody. But she wouldn't quit doing it, and then as time went on, we began getting days when she tore out 3 or 4 pages, which put her alone in a room for as much as 16 hours at a stretch, interfering with normal feeding and worrying my wife. But I felt that if you made a rule, you had to stick to it, had to be consistent, otherwise they get the wrong idea. She was about 14 months old or 15 months old at that point. Often, of course, she'd go to sleep after an hour or so of yelling. That was a mercy. Her room was very nice, with a nice wooden rocking horse and practically 100 dolls and stuffed animals. Lots of things to do in that room if you used your time wisely. Puzzles and things. Unfortunately, sometimes when we opened the door, we'd find that she'd torn more pages out of more books while she was inside, and these pages had to be added to the total in fairness. The baby's name was Born Dancin'. We gave the baby some of our wine, red, white, and blue, and spoke seriously to her. but it didn't do any good. I must say she got real clever. I'd come up to her where she was playing on the floor in those rare times when she was out of her room, and there'd be a book there open beside her, and you'd inspect it, and it would look perfectly all right. And then you'd look closely, and you'd find a page that had one little corner torn. Could easily pass for ordinary wear and tear, but I knew what she'd done. She'd torn off this little corner and swallowed it. So that had to count, and it did. They will go to any lengths to thwart you. My wife said that maybe we were being too rigid and that the baby was losing weight, but I pointed out to her that the baby had a long life to live and had to live in the world with others, had to live in a world where there were many, many rules, and that if you couldn't learn to play by the rules, you were going to be left out in the cold with no character, shunned and ostracized by everyone. The longest we ever kept her in her room consecutively was 88 hours. And that ended when my wife took the door off its hinges with a crowbar, even though the baby still owed us 12 hours because she was working off 24 pages. I put the door back on its hinges and added a big lock, one that opened only if you put a magnetic card in a slot. And I kept the card. But things didn't improve. The baby would come out of her room like a bat out of hell and rush to the nearest book, Goodnight Moon or whatever, and begin tearing pages out of it hand over fist. I mean, there'd be 34 pages of Goodnight Moon on the floor in 10 seconds, plus the covers. I began to get a little worried. When I added up her indebtedness in terms of hours, I could see that she wasn't going to get out of her room until 1992, if then. Also, she was looking pretty wan. She hadn't been to the park in weeks. We had more or less of an ethical crisis on our hands. I solved it by declaring that it was all right to tear pages out of books, and moreover, that it was all right to have torn pages out of books in the past. That is one of the satisfying things about being a parent. You've got a lot of moves, each one good as gold. The baby and I sit happily on the floor side by side, tearing pages out of books. And sometimes, just for fun, we go out on the street and smash a windshield together. Thank you.
You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. That was Donald Barthelme. He spoke at Portland Arts and Lectures in 1989. Thanks for joining us for the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. And we have lots of talks on our website. Listen to them all at literary-arts.org. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting, produced by Spencer Raymond. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.